Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Matsu Valley, RadioFreePalmer.org. And you can find all of our episodes over on MushingRadio.com and follow us on social media, searching for Mushing Radio. And on the line is Alex Stein, calling in from Southern California. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great here, Robert. How is the weather up in Willow?
You know, it is less than 10 degrees. We haven't had snow since before Christmas, and everything is ice. It's making it real tough to mush around here. But, you know, they're starting things for racing this weekend, and I'm looking forward to what we're talking about today.
Excellent. So today we're talking about the qualifying races for the Iditarod. And going back to the initially, when the Iditarod started, there was a very informal method of starting. And, in fact, in the first couple races, it was pretty much open to any member of the mushing community. After a couple of years, it was changed so that you had to, in order to run the race, you had to have someone who had run the race vouch for you. And that was the system that was in place for a while. And then eventually the Iditarod started sanctioning qualifying races, and you would have to complete a certain number of qualifying races in order to be able to qualify for the Iditarod. And for a while, it was, I believe, 500 miles of qualifying races, which would either be two 300-mile qualifiers or a 300-mile qualifier and two 150-mile qualifiers, or a 300-mile qualifier and a 200-mile qualifier. And that was the case up until about 2009. And in 2009, longtime listeners may remember, there were a couple of very, very bad and dangerous situations. There were several mushers who had dogs die, and there were two mushers who were stuck in a blizzard overnight, and it appeared for a while and seemed very likely to a lot of people who were in charge of the race that one or both of the mushers might have been in danger of dying. And luckily the Iditarod Air Force was able to come in and rescue them. But after that race, there was considerable thought given to making sure that all of the mushers who competed were properly prepared. And after that happened, they increased the number of miles required in qualifiers from 500 to 750, and also started requiring that new mushers, rookie mushers who were running the Iditarod, would have an established musher who had completed the Iditarod who was able to vouch for them. So they went back a little bit to that the way it had been in the first races. Additionally, a change that happened is when mushers are running qualified races, they are required to tell the organizers of those races that they're running qualifiers for the Iditarod, and then there is a report card on that musher that is prepared by the race organizers of the qualifier. So each musher will be evaluated on a number of criteria that will make sure that the mushers who are running Iditarod are able to handle the stresses of running a 1,000-mile dog race.
Right, and just recently, I don't think you mentioned this, Alex, but just recently they changed the rule that allows for multiple years in terms of when the qualifiers could be done. Back 3-4 years ago, all of the qualifiers had to be done in the calendar year before, but now it's changed where those can count. If you do, you know, a couple of them this year and a couple of them next year, then plan to run in 2018, those still count.
Right, and that is a good thing. It makes it easier for mushers to be able to complete their qualifiers. There's not such a mad dash to do it all in one year. The other major change, which I believe is happening for this coming year's race, rookies in 2016, if you complete a certain percentage of the Iditarod, so if you are still a rookie but you have not actually finished the race, if you completed, I believe it's 400 or 500 miles of it, that will count as one of your 300-mile qualifiers.
Nice. Anything else before we jump into the races themselves?
The only other thing is if you are someone who has completed an Iditarod, that counts for your qualifier, and you can run the Iditarod in the future, and you can take many years off and then come back and run it. At least that's the way the rules are currently.
Right. You know, this is often a topic that breeds up a heck of a lot of conversation, especially in the mushing crowd. Everybody's constantly talking about the qualifying races, and we're going to jump right into it here. This truly is the start of the mushing season up here in Alaska. The Copper Basin 300 is starting as we speak here at 10 a.m. Alaska time, so the first mushers are on the trail for the first 300-miler, and we're going to talk about that race in just a second. But before we do, we're going to concentrate on the Alaskan qualifying races. There are a whole bunch of them down in the lower 48 that a lot of folks do before they come up here, and then they run the Iditarod after that. And just a quick announcement of those, there's one in Montana called the Race to the Sky 350. There's one in Oregon called the Eagle Cap Extreme. I believe it's a 200. There's one in Minnesota called the John Bear Grease Marathon, which I believe is a 300 now. There's the UP 200, which is up on the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. There is one in Maine called the Can-Am. I believe it's a 250. I don't know for sure on that one. So there are several races down there in the lower 40, and I know there's a 150 or two down there as well. I just can't think of them right off the top that are also qualifiers. But, you know, we've talked a lot about it on this show, Alex, where, you know, it makes it tough for those mushers that live and train and race down in the lower 48 and they come up and run the Iditarod. They haven't had a whole lot of success. I know we talked a lot about that when we were talking about our mushing history with folks that won, and we talked about Doug Swingley being the first true outsider that came up from the lower 48 to win four Iditarods, but that doesn't happen very often, does it?
No, not at all. And in fact, even the people who have had a fair amount of success running Iditarod, who are originally from the lower 48, most of them wind up either relocating to Alaska or staying in Alaska for long periods of time. So it's a little bit tricky when you describe someone as being from a certain state, but you know that they are spending 5 or 6 months a year up in Alaska anyway.
Right. And I know Sebastian Schnull came out with an article just this week in the Alaska Dispatch, and he talked about him coming back to the Iditarod possibly next year. And in his article, he said that it's real difficult to run the Iditarod and everything fall into place correctly. And this really starts to come into play when you're thinking about these qualifying races. The way it usually works is usually the first week of October or so, it becomes a mad dash sitting in front of a computer screen trying to sign up for these qualifying races. Many of them fill up very quickly, some of them in less than 15 minutes for 40 or 50 spots. And then it's sort of a, you know, sit back and wait game to figure out what's going to happen with the weather. Is everything going to work out in terms of your mushing team? Is everybody prepared? Do you have enough money? Do you have any sponsors? Do you have dog injuries, et cetera, et cetera? So you're planning for this at least 3 or 4 months in advance. But as we mentioned when we started, this is something that usually happens at least a year in advance, especially in today's mushing world. You know, folks will come up a year in advance to run their qualifiers, and then they'll come back the next year and sign up for Iditarod in June, and then they'll run a qualifying race. It doesn't need to be a qualifier for them, but they'll run one of these qualifying races as practice runs for their Iditarod to prepare for that launch in March. But it, like I said, it's usually a year in advance to get everything going, and then they're prepared, they're signed up and ready to go. They have all their paperwork in and entry fees paid, and they're ready to go. Anything on that before we jump in?
Right. And, you know, a lot of people who follow Iditarod may not be aware of the fact that for many of these qualifying races, there is a very strict limit for how many teams can compete, and that's because they just physically do not have the infrastructure and the race courses are not set up to handle 80 or 100 teams. So you'll have races where sometimes the field is capped at 20 or 30 or 40 teams, and as you mentioned, it's a first come, first serve, and you have to sit there at your computer and try to get in, you know, just like people try to get concert tickets for very popular bands that they want to go see. So it's a difficult thing, and what you have to keep in mind is not only are there a lot of rookies or people who haven't run Iditarod before who are competing to run and who are trying to get in to run these races, but as you mentioned, a lot of veterans, a lot of people who have run Iditarod many times before just enter these races so that they can get a good idea of how their teams are doing for the coming season. You know, the Copper Basin, which is starting today, Ali Zirkle is running, Anna Barrington, Alan Moore, Ray Reddington Jr., Sebastian Schnulli. So you have a lot of veteran mushers and mushers that have a lot of experience, along with the up-and-coming mushers, maybe people who have run the Iditarod once or twice, and then people who have not yet run Iditarod who are trying to qualify to run it.
And real quickly, they often enter in several teams from the big kennels, like the Boosers or the Reddingtons or even the Zirkle clan. They'll enter two or three teams, and they'll run their puppy teams, they'll run their handlers, whoever, to get those dogs out on the trail. So let's jump into the races, starting with the Connect 200. And a quick note, we may leave one or two out. I'm kind of going off on memory here. So if we do, I apologize, but please send us a note if we had, and we'll make sure we'll send over links and things to that as well. So the first one, which has been plagued by weather for the last several years, at least since I've been up here since 2010, I think it's only gone off one or two times in the last 5 or 6 years. And one of those times, it was an abbreviated race last year where they only ran about 120 miles, and it's the 200. It's a race that's been around for a long time. It starts right there near the Reddington homestead there, runs 200 miles up the Yetna River, typically has the turnaround at Yetna, then they'll work their way back towards Willow and then back down to finish at Kinnick and or Willow, depending on the weather. But for folks that don't pay attention to the weather forecast, we've had a terrible time with early winter snow. Usually this is the first week of January when the Kinnick 200 takes place. The second one, which happens to be this weekend, the big boy of the races is the Copper Basin 300. It starts in Glen Allen, Alaska, which is about 100 miles, 150 miles or so from Anchorage. It's in the Copper River Basin. As Alex mentioned, a lot of people run this race as a training run, and it's also a very good preparer for the Iditarod. It's known as the toughest 300-mile race in Alaska. And what people often say is, if you've seen it on the Copper Basin and have done well, you will often do pretty well on the Iditarod. Anything on either the Kinnick or the Copper Basin, Alex?
Well, you know, when people are trying to figure out exactly which races that they can run in order to qualify, one of the things they have to take into account is as you mentioned, the Knick has been canceled a bunch of times in the past 4 or 5 years, and because it is a relatively southern race, because it starts right in Knick, outside of Anchorage, or outside of Wasilla, they have been having a lot of problems with snow in the past few years. So you have to take that into account when you're trying to strategically figure out which races you can get under your belt in order to qualify.
You know, that's a good point, Alex. For the last few years, I've attempted to sign up for all of these races, and several times I've been bumped out because of that crazy computer situation where everybody's signing up at once. But I've also signed up several years for all of the qualifying races, and then one or two of those races are canceled. And if one or two of those races are canceled, pretty much the clock starts all over the next year, because you're not qualified to run in the following year's Iditarod. So if you sign up for in October, remember, so if you sign up for the Knick 300, the Copper Basin, and the Northern Lights, which I did a few years ago, and then before the season even got started, two of those races were canceled. So I was kind of left holding the ball, unable to do my qualifiers because those races were canceled. So it makes a real interesting situation when you're signing up for things 4 or 5 months in advance. So the next race coming up, which is next weekend, is the Cusco 300. It starts in Bethel, which is on the western coast of Alaska. A relatively flat race, and it's one of the races that has the biggest purse in mushing. Do you know anything about that one?
I don't know much about it aside from the name, and that I have followed it a couple of times, but I'm not very familiar with it.
So last year, I believe there was quite a bit of controversy with the boosters with that race. I know Roan and Martin finished relatively close to each other, and they were talking about going down the wrong trail and you know, all of that. I believe we talked about that here on this show. And it's a race that that the boosters and the Kings, they kind of hold the keys to that race. They've won a lot of those races, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah, and those are, you know, because it's way over on the other side, it's not as easy a race for people to get to, and it's not, when you're planning on how you're going to qualify, I don't think that is one that immediately people would jump on, as opposed to the Copper Basin.
Right. The next weekend is typically a weekend that's sort of an off weekend, but they've changed things around and they've moved the Two Rivers 200. It's typically the same weekend as the Iditarod start. It's held up in Fairbanks, but they've moved it to the third weekend in January, and it runs starting in Two Rivers, which is sort of the home of all of the mushers that don't live in South Central here in Alaska. A lot of them live up in the Two Rivers area or thereabouts, when you're talking about Ken Anderson and Lance Mackey and Ali Zirkle and Ryan Olson, and all of those folks live up there in Two Rivers. Really great mushing country. And it runs along the first portion of the Yukon Quest there. It runs that first 100 miles or so up and down those foothills of the Alaska Range.
Right, and because that is located closer to Fairbanks, you're a little bit farther north, and there generally is not as much of a concern for not having enough snow and for having to cancel because of weather.
The following weekend, which is the last weekend of January, typically is when the Northern Lights 300 is held. That race typically starts in Big Lake. I know they've changed it around the last few years. It started in Willow. It started in Knick. It started there at Martin Booser's Kennel, around and around wherever they can find snow. It runs that first 150 miles or so of the Iditarod. It runs from one of those starting areas to Yetna, to Squintna, to Finger Lake, and then works its way back. A real tough race in terms of weather, a lot of river running as they do on the first of the Iditarod, And often you'll find a lot of those teams that we had mentioned where they'll enter three or four of those puppy teams or handler teams so they can get that first little taste of the Iditarod Trail. You often see all of those teams out there preparing for the Iditarod, which is coming up in about a month or so after that.
Right. And, you know, I just wanted to briefly mention that when we're talking about a 200 or 300 mile race, we're generally talking about something that can be done in a weekend or in 3 days. So it's not nearly as long a time commitment as the longer races, obviously, but it's long enough that teams can get a taste for what it's like to have a certain run rest schedule and to, in some cases, have to camp or have to be able to take care of a team over the course of a longer run day than, say, 60 or 70 or 100 miles.
Right. And we've talked a lot about on this show mandatory rest that is required. Each one of these races have some form of mandatory rest. I know that we talked about the Two Rivers 200. They have 10 hours of mandatory rest. Typically, the 300s will have 15 or 20 hours of mandatory rest. And as you mentioned, a lot of these races will start on Friday or Saturday, and they'll have their finisher's banquet on Monday evening. So it is something that they can get done relatively quickly and then head on down the trail to the next race. Starting in early February is when we have the start of the Yukon Quest and also the start of the Yukon Quest 300. Just like the big race, the Yukon Quest, it changes every year from 1 year running in Canada to Fairbanks, from Whitehorse to Fairbanks, and then the alternate year from Fairbanks to Whitehorse. Alex, which way is it running this year? Do you know?
I am not positive, but I believe it's starting in Fairbanks this year.
So the race in Fairbanks is one of the tougher 300s that there are because you run over all of those trails that we mentioned on the Two Rivers 200, but you're also crossing two of the highest summits on the Yukon Quest, Eagle Summit and American Summit. They're well over 3,000 feet in elevation, and they can make a real tough race. I know that on the Yukon Quest, there's all kinds of video out there of people really struggling on those peaks, isn't there?
Yeah, and yeah. People who have run both races generally will consider the Quest to be a much more physically demanding race, whereas the Iditarod is often described as a much more mentally demanding race and a race that requires a lot of strategy and a lot of planning and a lot of ability to adapt, whereas the Yukon Quest is just a very physically demanding race with a lot of ups and downs, a bunch of mountains that have to be crossed, some of which are very, very high and very difficult to get over.
So after the Yukon Quest 300 there in early February, I believe it starts the first Saturday in February, there's a race the second week of February that is a race that a heck of a lot of people don't know much about. It's called the Goose Bay 150. It's a relatively small race. I've raced in it a couple of times, and it's also a qualifier. Again, it's a 150-miler. It starts in Kinnick. It runs that first portion of the old Iditarod Trail. It'll run to Yetna and back. But it's one that a lot of folks don't know about. And when you're thinking about this 750-mile requirement, if you do two 300s and then that Goose Bay 150, there you go. You have your 750 miles all tidied up real quickly. They just recently changed that race to go in mid-February. It used to be held in later March, but they were having a real tough time with the trail with all the snow melting early in the spring, so they had to move it to a date that was a little bit better for snow conditions, so they moved it to mid-February. The third weekend in February is the Junior Iditarod, which is also 150 miles, and it's a race that, of course, juniors run. And this is one of those races when we talked about having them in your back pocket so you can run races in the future. You know, you can run the Junior Iditarod, I believe, at 12 or 14 years old, have that race in your pocket, and then not race again until you're an adult at 18 and still have that qualifier under your belt, that Junior Iditarod, so you can use that race as one of your qualifiers. Even if it's 3, 4, 5 years down the line, you can still use that in your back pocket. Do you know anything about those two races?
Right. You're absolutely right. And we have had a lot of people who have gone on to have great success in the Iditarod who have won or finished very, very well, very high up in the Junior Iditarod. One thing I wanted to mention is in order to run the Iditarod, you do have to be over the age of 18, which is part of the reason why the Junior Iditarod came into being, was to give younger mushers and mushers who are learning and grew up in a mushing culture a chance to compete. And I believe the first time Dallas Seavey ran Iditarod, the Iditarod, he was just a few weeks or maybe a month past his 18th birthday. So he was one of the youngest who has ever run the big race.
Wow. And since it is the Junior Iditarod, almost everything that they do in Iditarod, they will use for the Junior Iditarod. I know a couple of years ago on the Junior Iditarod, when my daughter ran Nicole, they were testing out the new tracker system that they use now on the big race, and they were testing it out a couple of weeks ahead of time. And all of the rules are very similar to Junior Iditarod in terms of communication. We talked a lot about two-way devices this year with Brent Sass and his issues on the trail. I know that they have that issue or they have that rule on the Junior Iditarod. The food drops are the same. They have a big banquet. So it is really a mini Iditarod for the youngsters.
Yeah, and from all I've heard, and I haven't directly experienced it, but from all I've heard, it is a really great and well-organized race and a wonderful experience for the teams.
And we're speaking about names. Barb Reddington is sort of the chair of that race. Everybody knows the Reddington name, so she's heavily involved with the Junior Iditarod. I don't know if she's considered the race marshal or she's just the chairman of the board, but she spends a heck of a lot of time all year preparing for this race for the kids. So the rest of March is kind of open. You'll often have races coming and going, in the late season, so to speak. I know that they've had the Sheep Mountain in March at one time or another, where it was a 200 and 300 miler. They've also had a race up in Nenana called the Old Mail Trail 200. They've done for the last couple of years, which was a qualifier. But typically, those races are tough because of that weather to schedule there in late March. So then in April is the big boy here in Alaska. It's called the Kobuk 440, and it starts in Kotzebue, and it runs there in the Arctic for 440 miles, so 220 miles out, 220 mile back. It's a tough race. Not only is it just bare open ground, but you're also racing in a spring race where those conditions can change very rapidly. It could be very windy. It could be very warm. But it's a tough race to get involved in, not only because it's a 440-miler, which is, half of the Iditarod distance almost, but it's an expensive race to get to. And it's, I believe, the most expensive qualifier to enter. I think it's $850 to enter this race. So it's a tough one on the pocketbook, not only to fly all of your dogs, but also to get there to get back. Do you know anything about the Kobuk?
Wow. Well, it's also, I believe it's the only qualifier that takes place all above the Arctic Circle. So while it's in April, so there would be much more light, it's still, you're not talking about a lot of light when you're that far north.
Right. And you see, Alex, how they've sort of done it in terms of mileage. They did it as a 440. So even though you do your 440, you can't turn around and do a 300 and be done because you don't have 750. You only have 740. So they've done it that way, I believe, deliberately, so that a person doesn't do the Kobuk 440 and then, you know, the Yukon Quest 300 or the Northern Lights. They do have to do that third race, which I think is paramount to training these young mushers. So as we mentioned, you have to have 750 miles, at least two 300s, and one 200 or 150. But I don't know. We've talked about this before. I know we're out of time. We're going to end up our show here in just a second. What do you think about this 750 hard line? Do you think it's preparing these guys to do what they have to do? You know, some of these folks have never been on the runners before, and we've talked a lot about the rented teams or the leased teams. They'll come up and run their qualifiers, and they're ready to go just like anybody else. They pay their entry fee, they get their sign-off from their musher, and they're ready to go. What are your thoughts about the 750 guideline?
You know, in a sense, it is a little bit arbitrary, but there has to be a way to draw the line between people who are prepared and people who aren't. And I think this is a good first step towards doing that. I think having the requirement that you have an established Iditarod musher vouch for you and say that you're ready is also a good step. I know that's a little bit controversial, and some people think that some of the Iditarod mushers will vouch for people that they've never seen. But I believe that a lot of people do take that requirement fairly seriously. And, you know, we talk a lot about the Iditarod as a race and as a competition. And, you know, I've said in the past, and I'll say again, that I think the Iditarod Trail Committee has a very, very difficult job for a lot of reasons. And one is that although they want to promote the sport of mushing and they want to encourage people to learn about mushing and to pursue mushing if they're interested and spend enough money that they can put on this race that is amazing and wonderful, they also have it foremost in their mind that they have to keep this a safe event for the dogs and for the mushers and for the volunteers. So balancing all of those things is a very, very difficult job that I never would want to do, that I do not envy. And I am not sure what the better way to do this would be, but I think that having the 750-mile requirement and having that mean that it's at least three significant races and having someone vouch for you is a good step.
You know, my last point here, Alex, is what do you think the future holds? You know, with the crazy weather that we're having up here in Alaska with the very little snow early in the year and it melting quite sooner than it has in the past, you know, it's becoming more difficult for folks to get in these races. Not only do they fill up so fast, but it's very difficult for new races to start. And one of the big reasons is you don't want to step on anybody's toes. So if all of the races are occurring in January and early February, it's tough to start a new race for another qualifier, whether it's a 200 or a 300 or whatever, because there just aren't dates to do it. So even though the races are filling up quickly, there isn't space and or weather to add other races. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's something that I worry about a lot, and the change in the climate seems to be coming a lot faster in Alaska than most people had thought it would. And I'm just hopeful that, you know, somehow we'll be able to figure out a way to have enough snow that we can put on these races, either by changing when they occur or moving some of them north, or, you know, whatever has to be done. It is shocking to me sometimes to think of how much less snow there is now than there was even like 6 or 7 years ago.
Oh, I totally agree. I look at pictures all the time of seasons past, and, you know, I look on that thing on Facebook where it shows your memories from years past. It comes up every day, and I'll often see on there what snow conditions we had in 2010. So I've only been here since 2010, and we'll often have feet of snow out in the yard, where this year we do have snow cover, but it's mostly ice now. So I don't know if it's just one of those El Nino years where things are kind of running their cycle. You know, you can't really predict or change the weather. It's one of those things, but it is difficult to have a mushing kennel down here in South Central Alaska, where not only all the population is, but where all the jobs are, and you know, where most people live in terms of mushing, in terms of having that job and, you know, that balance that we often talk about. It's making it tough. I know our family just can't pick up and move to Two Rivers or someplace like that where there is snow in order to only mush. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out over the next couple of years in terms of climate change and or snow and or schedule and how these things sort of play out. Alex, I know we're late on time here. I know we're doing this on a Saturday morning. I don't know if you're lounging around the house or getting ready to go to work, but do you have anything else to say before we close?
No, just let's all hope for snow.
Right. So make sure you do follow the Copper Basin. I believe it's CB300.com. They are over on Facebook. They're very good at updating relatively quickly on all the events that unfold there on the Copper Basin. I'm looking forward to seeing who's going to win that one. I think it could be somebody new this year. I know that Ryan Olson, who's ran with the Allie Zirkel kennel for the last several years and then broke out on her own and ran the Yukon Quest and did very well last year. She's a top contender. I know she got a lot of press coverage up here in the newspapers the last couple of weeks. So pay attention to her. Of course, you can always watch Alan Moore. He's very successful at the Copper Basin 300. He runs what is called the Black Team on the Zirkel kennel, Alan Moore and Allie Zirkel's kennel there, whereas she runs the Red Kennel, and they both run in the race together. So let's follow this one, Alex, and then we'll talk again in 2 weeks. How's that?
Absolutely, and just wanted to remind people that the Copper Basin has free GPS trackers on all of the sleds, so you can look online and see where exactly everyone is.
Good stuff. Alex, we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.